Good evening and Happy New Year's. Welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, December 31st, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, flood watch warning across California this weekend, recreational Dungeness crab fishery to open in last closed area in Humboldt after delayed due to public health risks, and late December storms deliver much needed snowpack and water supply for California. So stay tuned. Those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkyon, Wailaki, Wiat, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
The National Weather Service has put out a coastal flood watch for Humboldt County between Thursday morning and Saturday afternoon, warning coastal residents to prepare for flooding of roads and infrastructure near shorelines. Gabriel Zucker reports.
The National Weather Service in Eureka released a weather warning for the next couple of days. This included a coastal flood watch between Thursday morning through Saturday afternoon. KMUD talked with Kathleen Zonto, a service hydrologist with the Eureka National Weather Service. She explained the forecast for the weekend and the impact of king tides on the coast.
The general weather overview is we're expecting another storm system to impact Northwest California. We can see some rain as early as tomorrow, and it's going to last through the weekend. It could bring several inches over the course of the weekend, and with some of the highest intensity rainfall is predicted to be Friday night through early Saturday morning. And so just kind of generally speaking, we with this rainfall or this storm, we could see some stronger winds, and some possible small stream flood issues. The details of those we're still looking into with our afternoon forecast today. So we're looking at just potential wind products and flood watches. But that's kind of what we're looking at right now.
There are also king tides hitting the coast of Humboldt. This combined with the storm system creates a higher chance for flooding.
In addition to the storm system, we have some high astronomical tides that will be bringing king tides over the next few days to the coastal areas. But when we get storm events like this that can add a storm surge that will make the water a little even more higher than the highest tide. And so that means there can be some saltwater flooding, maybe a foot or even more above the high tide mark. And so that's around high tide the next few mornings is what we're expecting.
What exactly are king tides?
King tides are some of the largest tides of the year, and they're so big it's because the earth is closest to the sun, and even though it's winter, this is when we're closest, and then when the sun and the moon work together to generate just these much larger than typical tides. And so usually during the king tides we'll see some of the lowest lying areas along the shore and tidal waterways. Those can see flooding because the water level is so high, and then you throw a storm surge on top of that, then it's even higher. And so you can see roads or even some infrastructure impacted by the saltwater flooding from the ocean.
For safety, Zonto recommended that it is not safe to be close to the shoreline, and even driving during this weekend could be dangerous.
The ocean's going to be pretty big over the weekend. It won't be the biggest waves, but we have in the forecast, just on the marine forecast, we have like 10 to 15-foot seas predicted. So the ocean's going to be big. It's one of those good times to stay farther back. And then honestly, with the heavier rainfall, the strong winds, it's not a great time to be driving around. A lot of these small streams that we've seen flooding from the past few storm systems, they could see flooding again. If there's stronger winds, that also can knock down limbs. And so really, it's not safe to be driving underneath trees either. So going out and adventuring, it's not ideal during big storm events with all this water and and wind.
Zonto pointed out the locations at the highest risk of flooding, looking at lower areas up and down Humboldt.
The areas we expect to be impacted are the lowest areas around Humboldt Bay, like the parking lot at Moonstone Beach, even like Pebble Beach Drive up there, and Highway 101 near South Beach is kind of an area we're keeping our eye on. And then this goes for the low areas along Mendocino Coast as well.
There are no flood warnings yet, but Zonto expects the National Weather Service to issue a flood watch in the upcoming days. areas that should expect flooding are areas with small streams and places with poor drainage. She pointed out locations that saw flooding during the last storm.
You know, it could be the same zones that saw flooding from the last storm systems. And so a lot of them will be rural roads. It can be the roads along Elk River, freshwater. We don't know for sure, but with the type of event that's lining up, it's enough rainfall to see these streams come out of their banks. Another one to keep an eye on is Garcia River, and then even Mattole, too. I know there's a lot of rain in the forecast for southern Humboldt, and the Mattole can handle a lot of rain, but there could potentially be some flood issues down there as well.
Zonta suggested that folks keep an eye out on the forecast for updated alerts. The National Weather Service website is weather.gov/EKA/. For KMUD News, this is Gabriel Zucker.
Yesterday, the last area of the recreational Dungeness crab fishery in Humboldt opened after being delayed since November 1st due to elevated levels of domoic acid. State health agencies determined that the crab in waters from the southern boundary of Reading Rock Marine Protected Areas near Oric to Cape Mendocino can open. However, while it is open to fishing, the California Department of Public Health, CDPH, has issued a health advisory to not eat crab viscera or guts and to clean crab prior to cooking. KMUD News spoke to Christy Juhas, Senior Environmental Specialist, for more information about the reopening of the recreational Dungeness crab fishery.
So we start preseason testing for Dungeness crab typically late September and then October across the fishery between, you know, the California-Oregon border down to about San Luis Obispo area in the south. So we didn't see any issues in our crab samples from sort of the Bay Area, the Sonoma-Mendocino County line south, but we did start to see some really high exceedances in the gut tissue for crab samples in the north, and it was at multiple locations. One location in Mendocino County, where we have two testing locations, and then we have about four testing locations up in Humboldt County and two testing locations in Del Norte, and we saw exceedances at about, I want to say, most of the stations. I think one was able to clear, but the other ones we had to test multiple times. And the issue was we saw really high exceedances in the gut tissue, and when we see that, we start to also test the meat. And if the meat also reaches this federal action level as well, that will necessitate the need to close the recreational fishery. That began the first Saturday of November, November 1st, 2025. And it has been delayed in the Humboldt County area that just opened yesterday. It's been delayed since November 1st.
Domoic acid is caused by marine algae and is naturally occurring. When consumed, it can cause domoic acid toxicosis, which is when domoic acid attacks the brain and heart, causing seizures and heart failure. It can affect sea lions, seabirds, and humans, as well as other animals that ingest it.
So the domoic acid is caused by phytoplankton marine alga. It's naturally occurring. When this bloom proliferates, it enters the food web. It usually gets taken up by bivalves, and then possibly then the crab will take it up by eating these bivalves that have it in their tissues. And then, you know, if there's a certain level that is the federal action level is reached in the gut tissue, that's what precipitates additional testing to see when the domoic has dissipated in those tissue samples.
Following the recommendation of state health agencies, Acting Director of the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, CDFW, Valerie Termini, declared the recreational Dungeness crab fishery open in the remaining delayed area. The health advisory, in effect, advises those crabbing to be sure to clean their crabs prior to cooking.
Yeah, the health advisory is in effect because we were able to see lower exceedances in samples. So the meat has not reached those exceedances. We were able to get that in two subsequent samples taken at least a week apart. But we still see some exceedances, not as high as at the start of the season, but in the gut tissue. So just kind of the health advisory is in place to remind those people who want to eat crab that you can eat the meat, but it would be best to remove the viscera prior to cooking because domoic acid doesn't break down if you freeze or cook the crab. So you can remove it and cook it without the viscera or gut tissue and you should be fine.
While the recreational crab fishery is back open, commercial fishery still has other processes that have delayed the season. Initially delayed due to entanglement risk, there has also been a quality delay, tentatively pushing the start of the season back to January 15th for some areas.
Dungeness crab commercial fishery has multiple, some other processes that have further delayed their season, are, you know, operating now under like the entanglement risk program, as well as quality testing for the Northern California area. So unfortunately, we couldn't get quality tests done with these exceedances in both the meat and the gut tissue. And so we defaulted to a January 15th quality delay, unfortunately, without test results in hand for that meat quality test to determine whether or not crab were ready for harvest. Fishery was initially delayed by entanglement risk as well. We have certain thresholds that are met. There's two triggers. It's either an entanglement number for the calendar year or marine life concentration numbers. So we are looking at specifically humpback whales, blue whales, Pacific leatherback sea turtles, although those don't typically occur up in Northern California. Their range is more like Point Arena South. But we are looking at those triggers and whether or not they're met during these risk assessments when the season traditionally starts will, you know, initiate a management action from the director of Fish and Wildlife. So he did delay the season this year beyond January 1. So our central management area is going to open up January 5th. And our northern management area, we had to default to this quality testing delay as well, this drop-dead date of January 15th. So we're trying to get test results in to determine whether or not any areas will be further delayed in the commercial fishery. It's yet to be determined based on just continued testing. Because we do have the health advisory, we need to clear all the crab tests for the commercial fishery.
The commercial Dungeness crab fishery in the central management area near the Sonoma and Mendocino County line to Point Conception in Santa Barbara County will open January 5th under a 40% trap reduction. The commercial season in the northern management area, which spans from the California-Oregon border down to the Sonoma-Mendocino County line, will open January 15th under a 15% trap reduction, pending the results of ongoing domoic acid testing. For more information, the website is wildlife.ca.gov. Yesterday, December 30th, the Department of Water Resources, DWR, conducted the first snow survey of the season at the Phillips Station in the Sierra Nevadas. The manual survey recorded 24 inches of snow depth and a snow water equivalent of 5 inches, which is 50% of average for the location. Statewide, the snowpack is 71% of average for the state. The snow water equivalent measures the amount of water within a snowpack and is a key component of DWR's water supply forecast. The DWR held a survey discussion yesterday where they went over their findings at the Phillips Station. David Rosardo, one of the surveyists, speaks a bit about the findings.
A snow depth total of 24 inches, 2 feet of snow on the ground, which contains about 5 inches of water content. And that puts us at 50% of average to where we'd like to be today. In other words, we'd like 10 inches of water content to be on the ground right now to be at average. So if you look at how we were at this point last year, we're at about half of where we were last year. And last year did remarkably end up close to average when we got to April 1st. So just for Phillips Station, again, 5 inches of water content, that's about half of where we should be for the date, and it's about 21% or about a fifth of where we should be by April 1st. So a little bit behind pace of where we would like to be here on December 30th. When you broaden that out to the statewide look, this is based on our automated snow pillow network, you see a little bit different numbers. That's because a little bit heavier snowpack in the central and southern Sierra, thanks to these round of storms. We're about 24% of the April 1 average, so about a fourth of the way there, and 71% of average to date. Again, pretty stark contrast to where we were at this date last year. We were better off at this point last year.
Prior to last week's storms, California's statewide snowpack had been lacking due to above average temperatures and very little storm activity. However, these recent storms turned that around and provided a much needed boost to both the snowpack and the state's water supplies.
Two-thirds of where we need to be at this point. But when you look back at the 19th and you compare to where we are today, I think we're quite happy with where we're at. So it was an extremely dry, almost zero precip statewide leading up to the storms that happened over last week. And you can see that in the snowpack conditions back on the 19th. Statewide, we were at only 12% of average. In the Northern Sierra, only 4% of average. And then you kind of see the bookends of that for the data as of this morning. We went from 4% of average in the north up to 52% of or 51% of average. And the central 12 up to 72, quite a big boost there. The southern Sierra 34% up to 94%. So that boosted our statewide snowpack from 12% of average back on the 19th to 71% of average today. More importantly, that boosted our April 1 average up 21% over that time. So quite a big boost. And again, as I said, if you just looked at the numbers today and had no context from where we were back on the 19th, you might be a little disappointed. But when you give that context, you're quite thankful for the storms that we had, which were actually pretty warm in nature because they were atmospheric rivers. So could we have had more snow? Absolutely, yes. But again, I think we're quite thankful for what we had.
According to DWR's electronic readings from 130 stations placed throughout the Sierra Nevadas, the statewide snowpack snow water equivalent is 6.5 inches, or 71% of average for the state, compared to 115% last year. On average, the largest snow-producing months are January, February, and March in the Sierra Nevadas. The California climate is always marred by droughts and floods, and extreme whiplash between wet and dry is becoming more pronounced, not just year to year, but often within the same month or season. Dr. Mike Anderson, a state climatologist at DWR, speaks more about California's weather seasons.
The first half of December, very dry. Second part, with storms last week, have turned it quite wet. We'll look and see how January and February play out. As we get to spring and we get to the end of the wet season, it's when we look, keep an eye out for where is that peak snowpack, how big is it, and then really looking to see, do we get a little late season precip that really helps top things off? Or has the season turned dry early, in which case we have a longer dry season, an early melt, and a little more things to keep mindful of as we work through our dry season in terms of water management. Now we get summer here in California with our Mediterranean climate. We don't usually see a whole lot of precipitation in summer. On average, October through April accounts for 90% of the water year precipitation. But in the summer months, we watch the state dry out, how quickly it dries out, any heat anomalies, particularly those heat waves, not so many of this last year, but the year before, plentiful in July. The other piece we will need to keep an eye on, particularly we've noticed this recently with a lot of warmer water there in the eastern tropical Pacific, is tropical activity. As we get into August and September, the winds that would push those tropical systems away from California kind of ease up. That opens the door to that decaying system making its way into California, either bringing lightning or heavy rain.
Major reservoirs statewide are currently 123% of average due to the recent storms, on top of three consecutive years of above-average snowpack conditions. The Sierra snowpack supplies about 30% of California's water needs, and its natural ability to store water is why the snowpack is often referred to as California's frozen reservoir.
I think the trend that we're looking at right now is more rain than snow. Still good news that we have the snow, but we'd like to see the snow accumulation pick up by April 1st, so we're closer to average. And so that's still to be determined in terms of how this year works out. But January, February, and March are all big years, are big months in terms of snowpack accumulation. So we'll keep optimistic that we'll see that snow continue to accumulate.
DWR conduct four media-oriented snow surveys at this Phillips station every winter, near or on the first of each month, typically January through April, and if needed, May. The DWR's next survey is tentatively scheduled for February 3rd. In national news, Gaza families wait as ceasefire talks stall and uncertainty grows. KPFA's Rami Almagari reports.
At the Almani shelter camp in the western coastal area of Deir el-Balah, hundreds of displaced Palestinians say they are hoping for improved living conditions as the second phase of the ceasefire gets underway. Hope comes against the backdrop of political efforts underway, led by United States President Donald Trump. Iyad Abu Sada, a widow and mother of three, says she is struggling to survive after her husband was recently killed in the Jabali refugee camp. Now displaced, Iyad says she and her children urgently need support as they try to cope with the loss and ongoing humanitarian crisis.
بقول لك هدول الخيام في المرحلة الثانية، الخيام اللي بيبعتونا إياها الشرايط قلة عقل، هدول يبعتونا يعني.
In the upcoming second phase, we want real tents. We want mobile homes. We want nothing but a secure life, as we need blankets and mattresses. I am now a widow and a mother, and am depending on my parents, who live in the same shelter camp.
But Hamdi Ali, a displaced father of eight, says he has little hope that an expected second phase of the mediated ceasefire will bring meaningful relief for families like his.
No one is taking care of us except God. What we are asking for the most is for the war to end, so we can return to a normal life. We want our children back in their classrooms, to be able to feed them and care for them properly. Right now, we can't live, we can't work, and we can't even provide food for our children.
On Monday, Donald Trump met with Benjamin Netanyahu to discuss the second phase of the ceasefire. Trump has said he wants the next phase to begin early next year. Under the proposed second phase, a technocratic governing authority would be formed, Hamas would disarm, and Israeli forces would withdraw. The plan would then move into a reconstruction phase for Gaza. However, Netanyahu has insisted that Hamas must disarm before Israeli troops withdraw and the agreement can move forward. Mohammed Abu Jayab is an economic analyst from Gaza.
Clearly, the American administration wants to move this process forward as a political success, not necessarily out of concern for rebuilding Gaza, but to launch major projects across the Middle East and to expand the Abraham Accords before the end of President Trump's term. It's true that Israel has its own interests and objectives, but ultimately, U.S. interests are likely to prevail, which could support the ceasefire process and help accelerate Gaza's reconstruction. Still, that reconstruction faces enormous challenges, including logistical, technical, financial, and funding obstacles, as well as the realities of dense population and displacement.
Since October 2025, Donald Trump has pledged that the region would enter what he calls an unprecedented era of peace, saying it would be unlike anything seen in thousands of years. He has signaled determination to move forward with his 20-point plan aimed at ending the war in Gaza. The question now is whether the U.S. president can translate that ambition into a lasting peace. For Pacifica Radio, KPFA, I am Rami El-Mighari in Gaza.
In national native news, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is national native news. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The internment of Japanese Americans during World War II is among the chapters of U.S. history that the Trump administration is actively working to erase. It's part of a sweeping campaign to remove so-called disparaging signs and markers of the country's past and focus only on, quote, American greatness. In the final installment of a series on the camps, KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio visits the Colorado River Indian tribes to see how others are making sure victims are highlighted in, not erased, from the history books.
Inside a strip mall owned by the tribe, hundreds flock to its museum in Parker. Director Valerie Welsh-Tabo says her space used to be an old swimwear shop. Tucked in one teal-hued corner is an exhibit dedicated to the posting camp's 18,000 internees.
This was already up here, this structure in this store. And I said, let's hang on to this. Just because of where it was situated and because of the design, it just spawned that idea.
To honor Poston's past, another way the museum is paying respect is by welcoming Soto Zen Buddhist priest Duncan Ryukin Williams and his Irecho.
Cho means like a book or a registry. And so we created a book with everybody's names in it and said, how do we honor everyone? And we came up with this idea of stamping or placing this mark under people's names.
The Japanese word irei essentially means to console the spirits. And that's what Williams hopes his book does, by bringing forth personhood and dignity, one name at a time.
A lot of government camp officers mangle Japanese names, so we can't honor people if their names are misspelled.
And their goal
is to make sure all 125,284 people whose names are printed in this book get at least one mark of acknowledgement.
There's still 30,000 names unmarked, but Williams has a plan.
We'll just systematically, from the beginning of the book, invite the general public to come and place a mark under the next name in the sequence of names that doesn't yet have a mark.
Myself included.
I think this person, Hisao Kotsubo, Hisao Kotsubo, does not yet have a stamp. She's born in the year 1897. So if I could ask you to just place this stamp right under the letter H.
Their blue tip stamp is no bigger than your thumb. Some even practice that art of dotting with Susan Kamei.
It's a personal story.
Her parents, grandparents, and one set of great-grandparents were internees. Her dad's side was brought to Poston, while her mom's ended up in Heart Mountain, Wyoming.
I try to put myself in their shoes.
84-year-old Janet Brothers doesn't have to imagine, because she lived it.
I was here at camp as a baby. I was 6 months old, feeling the heat, looking around, seeing the desert and the mountains, knowing that that's what my parents saw every day. It was very emotional for me.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from Parker.
The National Congress of American Indians is remembering the life of former U.S. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who died Tuesday at age 92. NCAI President Mark Macaro, in a statement, said Campbell broke barriers and left a path for those who seek to follow as leaders in Indian country and in America. Campbell is being remembered for his work on Indian policy and elevating Indian country issues, serving on the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. The Associated Press reports his daughter said he died of natural causes, surrounded by family. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley, and thanks to our reporters, Gabriel Zucker, Rami Almagari, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMA News is online, and you can find us on KMA.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.